enemy walls, but that they instead had to go for broke and attempt an all-out assault on the fortress of San Lazaro. This was the sort of bold attack that Vernon had been constantly badgering Wentworth to try all along. And it was the type of strategy that had served the admiral well when he had captured Portobello. Wentworth had preferred a slower, more deliberate reduction of the enemy's defenses, followed by an attack. But with time slipping away and the sickly season in the tropics upon them, he at last gave in and agreed to the attempt. The plan was to launch a surprise attack by night. Over 1,500 men were detailed to go forward in two columns and scale the walls of the fortress using ladders. Some Spanish deserters promised to use their knowledge of the terrain to guide the columns up a gradually sloping section of the approaches to the fort so that the assault force could easily reach the walls. A variety of special equipment was prepared for the attack, ladders to scale the walls, large bundles of wool to fill in ditches, and satchels of grenades to clear the defenders from the walls. So as not to overly encumber the soldiers who would actually have to climb those walls, all of this paraphernalia was to be carried at the rear of the columns by a contingent of Americans delegated for that task. At 3 a.m. on the morning of April 9th, the two columns set off. Almost immediately, everything went wrong. The northernmost column, which was really intended as a distraction, got lost. The officer in charge was killed. The guide leading the column was killed. They came under heavy fire from the Spanish fortifications, and a counterattack compelled them to retreat. The main assault in the south fared no better. First of all, whether deliberately or through incompetence, the Spanish guide led them not to the easy gradual slope, but instead straight up a section of steep broken ground, which exhausted the men and disrupted the formation. Then they encountered some minor outer works, and in the dark mistook them for the main walls of the fort. The leading soldiers called for the ladders to be brought up, and chaos ensued while the Americans carrying them tried to work their way up to the front. Making things worse, a number of these bearers simply threw down their loads on the ground and deserted. After sorting themselves out a bit, the advance continued towards the now fully alert main fortress, which subjected them to a withering fire. All of this had served to delay the attack until the sun rose, making the column an even clearer target. Although a number of the officers were lost, the remnants of the column bravely staggered on and at last reached the main walls. Since most of the wool bundles and grenades had gone astray, when they were now desperately needed, very few were available. But the soldiers still had some ladders, and these were placed up against the walls, only for the men to discover, to their great consternation, that the ladders were 10 feet too short. The attack at last fizzled out, and the survivors tried to make their way back to safety. Before he died, one of the mortally wounded officers who had led this ill-fated assault was said to have exclaimed, "The general should hang the guide, and the king should hang the general." Out of the 1,500 men who had made the assault, 600 were casualties. By now, battle and illness had reduced the total number of effective British troops down to just a few thousand, and Vernon and Wentworth had no choice but to call off the campaign against Cartagena and depart. In the words of one 19th century commentator on this campaign, "Thus ended a very expensive exercise, which from the beginning was ill-conceived and miserably executed." In coming years, the two rivals and their respective adherents would each devote much effort to writing up accounts of the disaster, which basically attempted to place all the blame for it on the other. Vernon's career would survive the scandal, and he served for many more years as an officer and a politician, dying at the age of 72. Wentworth, likewise, subsequently had a political career, but he died within a decade. As for the intrepid Blas de Lezo, he died only 4 months after the defeat of the British expedition, apparently from an infection that he had caught during the siege. He has gone down in history, however, as one of Spain's greatest admirals. There are numerous sites in Cartagena that are named for him. A large heroic statue of him was erected in front of one of the city's fortresses, and several ships in both the Spanish and Colombian navies bear his name. Even in a course on military blunders, the entire story of the attack on Cartagena stands out as an astonishing sequence of errors and stupidity. Above all, Vernon's and Wentworth's failure to cooperate demonstrates the dangers of placing one's personal feelings above the good of the group, as well as the essential need for teamwork and mutual support when different branches of an armed service are called upon to work together. Two interesting footnotes to this campaign both involve George Washington. The first is that George's brother, Lawrence, who participated in the expedition, was apparently among Admiral Vernon's supporters. And we know this because when Lawrence returned to Virginia and happened to inherit an estate there, he named it Mount Vernon in honor of his former commander. When in turn George Washington inherited the property, he kept the name. The second is that when George was still just a teenager, Lawrence used his British naval connections to arrange for George to be enlisted in the Royal Navy as a midshipman or a junior officer. However, George's mother objected so strenuously to this plan that it was canceled. One can only imagine how different all of subsequent history might have been if George had left America and pursued a career as a British naval officer rather than becoming a leader of the American Revolution.
Lecture 11, Culloden. The Bonnie Prince blunders.
On August 3rd, 1745, Prince Charles Edward Stuart, the son of the exiled claimant to the thrones of both England and Scotland, landed from a French warship onto a desolate beach on the western shore of Scotland. His intent was nothing less than to raise a rebellion, to overthrow what he viewed as the foreign usurpers who had stolen his birthright, and to restore the rule of the House of Stuart over England and Scotland. For one harboring such grand ambitions, his arrival did not seem very impressive. He was accompanied by only 7 supporters, and they had almost no money or weapons. There had been a second larger French ship that had been transporting a company of troops, a cache of arms, and his treasury. But that ship had been intercepted by an English warship and forced to turn back. What Prince Charles lacked in material support, he made up for with an unshakable confidence in himself and his cause. When the first Scottish lord that he made contact with on an island just offshore bluntly urged him to give up the attempt and go back to France, the prince utterly rejected this advice and with serene self-assurance declared, "I am come home, sir." His arrival initiated a tumultuous period that would include multiple battles and even a dramatic invasion of England itself, which featured a dangerous thrust right towards the capital city of London. And finally, 9 months after the prince's landing in Scotland, the entire campaign would culminate with the Battle of Culloden. There, on a bleak patch of Scottish moor, the fate and the future of the prince, as well as of England and Scotland, would be determined. The seeds of the Battle of Culloden had really been sown 58 years earlier, when the Catholic king, James II of the House of Stuart, was deposed as the king of England and Scotland. The throne was eventually filled by a new king belonging to the House of Hanover from Germany. His name was George I. George's claim was honestly rather tenuous. He was the 51st in the line of succession. But he was a Protestant. And in this era of back-and-forth religious strife, a law had been pushed through that now excluded Catholics from occupying the throne. The deposed Catholic king, James II, lived out the rest of his life in exile. But there were many factions back in England, and especially in Scotland, who cherished hopes of his restoration. These supporters were termed Jacobites. That's after the Latin version of James's name. When he died, his son, James Francis Stuart, sometimes called the Old Pretender or the King over the Water, became the new heir in absentia. And his son, in turn, was Prince Charles Stuart, the one who led the attempt to recapture the throne that would end at the Battle of Culloden. Prince Charles's opponent at that battle was the son of the current Hanoverian King of England, and his name was William Augustus, the Duke of Cumberland. Culloden would thus be a struggle between two rival princes, each one of them defending his father's claim to the throne. So let's begin by examining these two commanders in a bit more detail. Prince Charles, the leader of the Jacobite army at Culloden, had spent his whole life as an exiled royal. He was born in Rome on the very last day of 1720, and he had had bestowed upon him the rather lengthy full name of Charles Edward Louis John Casimir Sylvester Severino Maria Stuart. His mother traced her ancestry back to the fabled Polish general Jan Sobieski. Charles grew to adulthood pursuing the lifestyle of the idle rich. He devoted a great deal of time to hunting, and he developed an excessive fondness for alcohol. His one driving passion, though, was a feeling of deep resentment that his family had been denied its inheritance, and he firmly believed that he was the man to gain it back. One of the nicknames commonly applied to the prince, particularly in subsequent romanticized accounts of his rebellion, is Bonnie Prince Charlie. And at the time of Culloden, he does indeed seem to have cut a handsome, dashing figure. Remember, he was only 25 years old then, and he was an excellent athlete who had excelled at all sorts of sports as a child. Good-looking and charismatic, he absolutely radiated confidence in himself and dedication to his cause. Unfortunately, his superficial attractiveness was not backed up by other, maybe less visible but essential, virtues for a military leader. In terms of intellectual ability, he was mediocre at best. And he appears to have had little or no sense of strategic or tactical vision. He was blithely indifferent to pragmatic issues of logistics or terrain, which matter a great deal in warfare. In battle, he seemed to often freeze and to just leave everything to his subordinates rather than exercising decisive command. As one modern commentator put it, his presence on the battlefield was decorative rather than useful. The prince's most important subordinate officer was a Scottish lord named George Murray. Murray was a decent general, but he had a prickly personality, which created considerable friction with the other Jacobite commanders, and particularly with a group of Irish advisors who had a lot of influence over the prince. As a result of this, the prince never fully trusted Murray and had quite frequent and public fallings out with him. The British commander at Culloden was William Augustus, the Duke of Cumberland. He was the second and really the favorite son of the current English king, George II. As you might expect, he received an excellent education, and he was steered towards a military career in his youth. Supposedly, his own natural inclinations lay in that direction anyway. One story claims that as a young boy, he had impressed his elders by organizing a group of fellow children into military formations and then putting them through rigorous maneuvers in the courtyard of the Palace of St. James. After a brief stint in the Navy as a teenager, the young Duke decided that he preferred to serve on the land. And so he began a career as an officer in the British Army. He saw action in Europe, and at the Battle of Dettingen, he was shot through the calf by a musket ball. Despite that wound, he coolly continued issuing orders, even instructing the surgeon to tend first to a more severely wounded soldier. He soon rose to the rank of general, and he exercised command in several more battles, not always entirely successfully. While there's no doubt as to his personal bravery, his tactical abilities were somewhat unimaginative. He tended to be just a bit cautious and conservative. But on the other hand, that same tendency also ensured that he rarely made any serious errors on the battlefield. The Duke of Cumberland's real talent, however, lay in the realm of administration and organization. He was very strict, maybe even excessively harsh at times, but he was extremely successful at instilling discipline and confidence in his troops. And that vigorous preparation would serve them well at Culloden. In contrast, though, to the slim, handsome Prince Charles, the Duke was quite stout. He had a round face, close-set eyes, and a substantial double chin. So while presenting a far less inspiring appearance than his antagonist, the Duke was really a much more reliable and experienced commander. Despite its inauspicious start, the Jacobite Rebellion gained considerable momentum, and many Highland and Lowland clans joined in, although some also remained loyal to the Hanoverian king. The rebels managed to win several victories, and buoyed by that success, they decided to launch an invasion of England itself. This move seems to have caught the English by surprise, and the invaders reached Derby, that's within about 120 miles of London, before fear of the British army that was being gathered up by the Duke of Cumberland caused them finally to retreat back to Scotland and to focus on trying to reduce and capture English strong points there. Cumberland eventually pursued them, and so the stage was now set for a final confrontation. This came when Cumberland marched his army from Aberdeen towards Inverness. That's the area around which the Jacobite army was operating. In anticipation of battle, Cumberland gave his men a rest day so that they would be fresh for the crucial conflict. This also happened to be his 25th birthday, which made him exactly the same age as his opponent, Prince Charles. When the Jacobite scouts detected the proximity of the British, an extremely daring plan was devised. It called for the Jacobites to march in several columns in the middle of the night to where the British were encamped and then to launch a surprise assault upon them. In warfare, nocturnal attacks are always a chancy proposition. They require extremely well-trained and disciplined troops to pull off. The motley assemblage of clansmen was neither. Predictably, in the dark, chaos took over, and the march took far longer than they had anticipated. Even before reaching the jumping-off point, Lord Murray realized that they would just never be able to launch the attack before dawn. So, abandoning the attempt, he turned the division that he was leading aside and led them back to the Jacobite camp. Unfortunately, though, he failed to inform the other divisions of his actions, and they were still blundering about in the dark. So they kept going, only to discover, as dawn was breaking, that they were all alone facing the entire British army. After a little bit of further confusion, they too withdrew and retreated back to their own encampment. In addition to provoking heated recriminations among the already contentious rebel leadership, the net result of this operation was that the Jacobite army spent a very fatiguing night plodding back and forth across the landscape for no purpose, leaving all the men demoralized and utterly worn out. With the regiments in disorder and scattered all around, many men simply flung themselves down onto the damp, chilly ground and fell into an exhausted sleep. At this moment, word arrived that the well-rested British army, having fortified themselves with a light breakfast accompanied by some brandy, was bearing down upon them, and battle was imminent. Further compounding the Jacobites' unreadiness was the fact that they had failed to bring sufficient provisions from Inverness, so that there was no food available to try to revive the dispirited men. Many of those who were still awake had dispersed throughout the countryside, foraging for something to eat. With so many men either asleep somewhere in the heather or roaming about foraging, the Jacobite army was now too small to hold the position that they had originally selected from which to give battle. So they had no choice but to fall back to the secondary position on Culloden Moor. Under the circumstances, it really might have been wisest to withdraw even further and to defer combat until another time. However, the prince, confident as always in himself and believing that his Highlanders would vanquish any foe, was determined to fight that day. An eyewitness observed, "The prince, who was always eager to give battle without reflecting on the consequences, was told that as the Highlanders were exhausted with fatigue, dispersed and buried in deep sleep in the neighboring hamlets and enclosures, many could not be present. Besides, what could be expected from men in their situation? They were not possessed of supernatural strength. The prince, however, would listen to no advice and resolved on giving battle." Thus, the groups of clansmen gradually assembled between two sets of stone-walled enclosures on the moor of Culloden. In front of them, between the walls, stretched an open field of wet, boggy ground. They were drawn up by clan groups, with Murray in charge of the right wing, Drummond in the center, Perth on the left, and the prince was situated behind the line, more or less in the middle. Fearing that the walls of the stone enclosures might impede the charge of the Highlanders, Murray asked permission to tear some of them down. But the prince refused, and this was a decision that would ultimately prove detrimental. As the army assembled for battle, there was squabbling regarding who should have the supposed place of honor on the right side of the line. This was a debate that caused further delay and engendered ill feelings among the always rather touchy clan groups. Each of them felt that, of course, it was entitled to this privilege. Altogether, the Jacobites probably numbered around 5,000, although there were hopes that maybe up to an additional 2,000 who were still asleep, foraging, or scattered all over the landscape would eventually arrive and join in. As they formed a clumpy, uneven battle line, they were pelted by a cold rain, and the mood of the men was sour. On the other side of the moor, the Duke of Cumberland arrayed his men in two main battle lines, with the reserves assembled behind these, forming really a shorter third line. A unit of cavalry was stationed on the left of the British formation, accompanied by a battalion of Highlanders who were loyal to the Royalist cause. Recognizing that they might be able to outflank the Jacobites by sneaking through the enclosures, these men began to tear holes in some of the walls in order to allow the British cavalry to pass through them. And this maneuver would eventually bring them to a position in the rear of the Jacobite line. Each side had deployed a small number of light cannons, and the battle actually began with the Jacobite artillerymen opening fire. The British cannons soon replied. There are several very contentious issues regarding the Battle of Culloden, and one of them is the duration and the effectiveness of this artillery exchange. An older tradition claims that after just a couple shots, the Jacobite cannons ran out of powder and became useless. While on the other hand, the well-served British guns pounded the helpless ranks of clansmen who were standing in their formations, making them very easy targets, for a full hour, and this inflicted enormous casualties, supposedly, upon them. This long, debilitating punishment has been blamed on the indecisiveness of the prince, who was hoping that the British would attack him. And when instead they subjected his army to this bombardment, he could not decide what to do. Against this, some newer interpretations say that the cannonade lasted a mere 5 minutes. That's probably closer to the truth, although it does seem that the British guns were far more effective than their Jacobite counterparts, and the rebel army certainly suffered much heavier casualties. Even if the number of Jacobites killed was in the dozens rather than the hundreds, being subjected to that terrifying bombardment would not have helped the morale or the battle readiness of the soldiers. The Jacobites were clearly getting the worst of this exchange, and the Duke of Cumberland was more than happy to just sit back and let his guns cut down the enemy. The clansmen's usual method of fighting was an enthusiastic charge in which they dashed forward in a mob, discharged any firearms they had at relatively close range, and then closed in to fight hand to hand. That was a style of warfare that emphasized individual bravery rather than group cooperation, and so it suited the temperament of the Highlanders. After some delay and failed attempts to give the order, the clans at last received the order to charge the enemy. The Jacobites surged forward in kind of a ragged line, clumping together in three groups, on the right, left, and center. On the right edge of their line, the enclosure walls projected out into the path of their charge, and this caused the men there to become funneled together into a tighter mass. Some of the center contingents also veered in this direction, so that the heaviest weight of the Jacobite charge became focused somewhat accidentally on the right side of their line. This clumping together made them better targets for British cannon and musket fire, but it also gave the attack on that side of the field greater momentum and strength. As the howling clansmen rushed forward, they were subjected to the volley fire of the British muskets, and although many fell, they ran on undeterred. At the Jacobite left and center, the disciplined British volleys, backed up by the bayonets of the redcoats, were successful in repelling the charge. But on the right, where more of the Highlanders had become concentrated, they crashed into the first wall of British soldiers, and a frenzied melee ensued. Clansmen slashed wildly with their long, straight swords, while the redcoats jabbed viciously with their bayonets. So fierce was the assault that the first line of British was pushed backwards, creating a deep dent in the overall formation. In some places, the Jacobites broke through and engaged the second line of British troops. This was the crisis point of the battle. If the Jacobites could shatter the redcoats here, they might then turn and roll up the entire British line. It's indicative of the savagery of the fighting that one of the British units that bore the brunt of this assault, the 4th Foot, quickly suffered 125 casualties out of a total of 373 men. On the other side, out of 21 officers commanding Clan Chattan, only 3 survived. The British brought up more troops to try to contain and surround the breakthrough, and this section of the battlefield became a cauldron of death. Today, if you visit the battlefield, the density of graves on that site vividly records the slaughter that took place there. Probably more than 700 Jacobites were killed in just a few minutes of intense fighting. Lord Murray attempted to push forward some of the Jacobite reserves, but the tide was already starting to turn in favor of the British, and the charge faltered. Rebels began to break away and run back towards their side of the field, pursued by the triumphant British. On the Jacobite left, which had already been repulsed, some British cavalry now galloped forward and began to cut down the fleeing rebels. While all of this was going on, the main group of British cavalry on the Jacobite right had infiltrated their way through all those enclosures and engaged units of clansmen who had been detached to counter their flanking movement. From the walls of the enclosure itself, that contingent of royalist Highlanders who were accompanying the cavalry had also been able to fire into the flank of the charging clansmen, and they too now advanced on the fleeing rebels. Under all these pressures, the Jacobite army crumbled, and individuals just sought to save themselves. The British claimed to have found a note during the battle, instructing the Jacobite soldiers to give no quarter to any captured British troops. And now, in an infamous episode, they themselves killed most of the wounded Jacobites that they encountered, bayoneting them as the clansmen lay helpless on the field. An English observer stated, "The moor was covered with blood, and our men, what with killing the enemy, dabbling their feet in the blood, and splashing about on one another, looked like so many butchers rather than soldiers." The Jacobites had suffered nearly 2,000 casualties versus just 310 for the British. In the aftermath of Culloden, the British were determined to stamp out any trace of rebellion in the Highlands of Scotland. And they embarked on a notorious punitive campaign of oppression, which has become known as the Clearances. Thousands of people were imprisoned, executed, or deported. Farms were demolished and their tenants evicted to make way for large-scale sheep herding. And really, the old way of life centered around the clans was destroyed. Anything perceived as encouraging Highland culture was officially banned. That included the playing of bagpipes, wearing clan tartans and kilts, owning Scottish broadswords, and speaking Gaelic. Garrisons were established and roads and forts constructed to facilitate control over the region. The memory of this era and of the harshness with which these measures were imposed is still today a source of anger and resentment for some. It's interesting to speculate how, if the Jacobites had won Culloden and the Stuarts been restored, how subsequent history might have been different. You would have had a pro-French monarchy in charge of England. At Culloden, however, the Jacobites were outnumbered, exhausted, outgunned, and poorly led. The Jacobite commanders' rivalries and their failure to work together, coupled with the prince's poor decisions and waffling, were just no match for the discipline, firepower, and professionalism of the British redcoats. Thus, the last charge of the Highlanders was doomed. Culloden would also be the last major battle fought on British soil. It effectively ended attempts at Scottish independence for centuries to come, and it firmly established the Hanoverian kings on the English throne, where their descendants continue to rule today. What happened to the ill-fated Prince Charles? Well, when he saw that the battle was lost, he fled the field, saying, "Let every man seek his own safety the best way he can." He managed to hide out in Scotland, dodging English pursuers for a while, and then escaped on a ship and returned to France. Abandoning the attempt to restore the House of Stuart, he gave himself up to womanizing and drinking, and he ultimately died in Rome in 1788. Murray also eventually fled to the continent, but he was shunned by the prince, who blamed him for the rebellion's failure. The Duke of Cumberland initially received great acclaim for his victory, but as time went on, his reputation suffered due to the slaughter of the wounded and the harshness of the clearances. His legacy remains controversial. Some admire his skill and dedication, while others condemn him as a perpetrator of atrocities. And this split is reflected in the nicknames that he has acquired, with his supporters and admirers calling him Sweet William, but his critics labeling him indelibly as the Butcher.
Lecture 12, Russia, Napoleon Retreats in the Snow.
On June 23rd, 1812, Napoleon Bonaparte crossed the River Niemen and invaded Russia. He went at the head of a vast force numbering nearly 500,000 men. This was the largest army that Napoleon had ever commanded, and it was full of battle-hardened and loyal veterans. Napoleon himself enjoyed a reputation as a brilliant and creative general who had already defeated every other continental European nation. The French Empire stretched from Spain to Poland, and it seemed inevitable that he would add Russia to his long list of conquests. In just 6 months, however, this seemingly invincible army would be completely shattered and destroyed. Of the 500,000 soldiers who cheerfully and confidently marched into Russia on that sunny June day, more than 90% would be lost to death, wounds, or capture. The disastrous invasion of Russia in 1812 initiated Napoleon's decline, and it was a process that would culminate a few years later on the battlefields of Leipzig and Waterloo. While today we can point to the invasion of Russia as a crucial turning point in history and in Napoleon's fortunes, none of that was apparent at the time. To the contrary, at the beginning of 1812, Napoleon Bonaparte was at the very apex of his power, capping a spectacular rise from obscurity. Starting from relatively humble origins on the island of Corsica, he had gained a reputation for daring as a young artillery officer. Then, adroitly negotiating the complex web of French revolutionary politics, he quickly attained the rank of general, and he put together a whole string of impressive victories. In 1799, he staged a coup and effectively became ruler of France under the title First Consul. He moved from success to success and was crowned Emperor of France in 1804. Despite having nearly all the other European nations arrayed against him, he defeated them one after the other, repeatedly winning dazzling victories over Russia, Austria, and Prussia. By 1810, he had expanded the territory of France and established himself, or in some cases his puppets, on the thrones of Spain, Italy, Holland, Sweden, Naples, and Bavaria. Austria and Russia had been coerced into signing treaties that made them somewhat reluctant allies of France, but they were made to support its policies. The only nation that had constantly remained an enemy was England, which was protected from invasion by Napoleon's Grand Army by the barrier of the English Channel guarded by the Royal Navy. Napoleon's attempt to break England economically through an embargo, which was known as the Continental System, was not working. And additionally, it was provoking considerable resentment from Russia, which was suffering economically as well. Napoleon seems to have become convinced that in order to provide lasting security for his empire, it was necessary to permanently remove Russia as a potential rival and threat. Although both countries officially claimed to want peace, they began to edge towards war. Napoleon's meddling in Polish affairs also aroused suspicion and anger in Russia. That's because Russia regarded Poland as belonging to its sphere of influence. Another contributory factor was Napoleon's personality. As his triumphs mounted, so did his ambitions and his ego. From early in his career, Napoleon believed that he was a specially chosen agent of fate, and he had an almost mystical conviction of the inevitability of his own glory. He once declared, "Is there any man blind enough not to see that destiny directs all my operations?" Thus, Napoleon selected Russia as his next target, and he began to plan for the invasion. He was well aware of the difficulties of the task facing him, commenting that, "I am embarking on the greatest and most difficult enterprise that I have so far attempted." Anyone who hoped to conquer Russia had two formidable obstacles to overcome before even considering the Russian army. The first of these was the sheer size of the country, which could just swallow up an invading army. It could stretch out the army's supply lines and wear it down. To reach any of the key Russian cities, such as St. Petersburg or Moscow, an attacker had to traverse hundreds of miles of featureless grassy plains. The second factor was the Russian winter. If a campaign was not concluded before the onset of Russia's legendarily harsh winters, the cold and the snow could obliterate an entire army. Nevertheless, Napoleon had faith in his own abilities, as well as in the huge army of seasoned veterans that he commanded. Napoleon intended to beat the Russians quickly, long before the first snows came. His plan was to march rapidly towards Moscow, forcing the main Russian army to confront him. Surely his splendid Grand Army would be able to then destroy the Russian one. That victory, at least in Napoleon's thinking, would then compel the Russians to surrender. Napoleon believed that if he could inflict but a single major defeat on the Russians, they would become utterly demoralized and all resistance would just crumble away. Napoleon confidently proclaimed that barbarian peoples are simple-minded and superstitious. A shattering blow dealt at the heart of the empire on Moscow the Great, Moscow the Holy, will deliver to me in one instant the entire blind and helpless mass. By the way, these sentiments are eerily similar to those expressed by Hitler a century later, when he declared, while contemplating his own invasion of Russia, that you have only to kick in the door and the whole rotten structure will come crashing down. When making all these plans, Napoleon badly misjudged the fundamental nature of the Russians. As they repeatedly demonstrated over nearly a millennium, they were more than capable of a stubborn and prolonged defense against any foe who dared to invade the motherland. Including the army stationed in Germany and Poland who were covering his advance, Napoleon had committed close to 700,000 men to the scheme. Napoleon and his staff watched from a slight rise as his army poured across the Niemen. The event had something in the mood of a parade, as one French officer observed. He said, "Each regiment marched behind its band, which played fanfares that mingled with cries of Vive l'Empereur. All the finest men in full dress, all the most beautiful horses of Europe, were brought together there under our eyes. The sun shone on the bronze of 1,200 cannon, ready to destroy everything. It shone on the breasts of our superb carabiniers with their gilded helmets and scarlet manes. The men reveled in their shared sense of power. Some thought of Caesar, some of the Crusades. Eventually, Napoleon joined in, symbolically mounted on a horse named Moscow." A key component of his main army was a formidable contingent of experienced cavalry. Chief among the mounted divisions was a special, extra-large force of no fewer than 40,000 cavalry, gathered together under the command of the flamboyant general Murat. Murat was famous for his bizarre, self-designed costumes made out of gaudy fabrics encrusted with jewels and fur, and he also had an unusually long mane of brown hair that he wore in extravagant curls. Murat was visually striking. In addition to a large array of outfits, Murat brought along on campaign an entire wagon filled with scents and cosmetics. Now, while his appearance may have been eccentric, he was an inspirational and very aggressive leader who was completely without fear on the battlefield. While these qualities, coupled with his total loyalty, endeared him to Napoleon, he was not the most intellectually gifted commander. Even Napoleon once famously labeled him an imbecile. Napoleon wanted to use Murat and his giant cavalry force as a mobile attacking advance guard. But by grouping so many horses together, it created a logistical nightmare trying to feed and water them all. The result was that after just a few weeks of campaigning, many of the poor creatures were so debilitated that far from being able to vigorously charge the enemy at a gallop, they could barely shamble along at a walking pace. As the army marched forward into Russia, the men, too, began to suffer. There was little water, and the heat of late summer was enervating. The temperature was hovering close to 100 degrees. The long lines of parched men plodded through a perpetual cloud of dust and dried excrement from the thousands of animals. The soldiers suffered from dehydration. Some were felled by dysentery, and others just dropped dead of heat stroke. Before even encountering the Russians, the army was decreasing rapidly. For example, one especially hard-hit company was reduced from its normal strength of 150 men down to only 38 combat-ready soldiers. Three separate Russian armies had been stationed along the border, But when the French invaded, rather than standing and giving Napoleon the battle that he was seeking, they all fell back into the interior of Russia. One of these armies was lagging a bit behind the others, however, and Napoleon saw a chance now to encircle and destroy it. He gave orders that the southern prong of his army should move forward quickly to cut off the Russians' retreat. Unfortunately, in an instance of poor decision-making and, frankly, nepotism, Napoleon had placed his younger brother, Jerome, in charge of this section of the army. Jerome lacked both his elder brother's military skills and his drive, and so he moved too slowly, allowing the Russians to escape the trap. In a rage, Napoleon dispatched a messenger to Jerome with instructions to tell him that it would be impossible to maneuver more ineptly than he has. A sullen Jerome resigned and was replaced with a more competent commander. But a vital opportunity to weaken the Russian army had been irreparably lost. Napoleon pushed on, deeper and deeper into Russia. He captured huge expanses of territory, he won some minor skirmishes, and he began to take possession of some of the large cities of Russia, such as Minsk and Smolensk. By late August, he had advanced 300 miles, but still the decisive battle that he desperately sought continued to elude him. His army also continued to hemorrhage men daily to disease and fatigue. Moscow was still 250 miles distant. Some of Napoleon's senior advisors began to suggest to him that he might consider cutting his losses and returning to Poland. But with his personality, Napoleon could not admit failure. He announced, "We are now committed too far to draw back. So close to the goal, there can be no discussion. Let us march on to Moscow." Napoleon was sure that if he threatened that city, the Russians would have to finally stop and face him. As it turned out, the Russians were intending to make a stand. The Tsar and others felt that it was shameful to allow the French to continue unopposed. Still, they wanted to compel the French to march as far as possible and then engage them on favorable terms. So they selected a strong defensible position near the village of Borodino. This was just 70 miles west of Moscow. There, they concentrated together the Russian armies, and they started to construct fortifications that would make it even more difficult for the French to overrun them. The numbers of troops committed to battle by the French and Russians at Borodino were roughly equal. There were 130 to 150,000 men on each side. Napoleon, though, atypically, chose a rather clumsy frontal assault on the Russian strong points, rejecting suggestions that he instead outflank the Russians and attack them from behind. The result of this was a day-long slugging match, with the French repeatedly, crudely assaulting the Russian fortifications head-on. As the day went by, several of these fortifications were captured and then recaptured by the Russians, only to be attacked more times by the French. After a long day of brutal and determined fighting by both sides, the Russians withdrew from the field, making it notionally a French victory. The losses on both sides at the Battle of Borodino were staggering. The Russians had suffered an estimated 45,000 casualties, including 29 of their generals, while the French lost about 30,000 men and 48 generals. Adding to the overall carnage, the carcasses of over 35,000 slain horses also littered the field. It was arguably the bloodiest one-day European battle prior to the 20th century. It's been calculated that the French cannon fired nearly 100,000 shots, and that the French soldiers discharged nearly 1.5 million balls from their muskets. With all of that firepower concentrated in a relatively small space, and each side launching repeated attacks and counterattacks during the struggle for those fortifications, the number of deaths at Borodino was unusually high. While the Russian army may have technically yielded the field of Borodino and retreated backwards yet again, their army had not been destroyed, as Napoleon had been hoping for. Nor had the Russians' will to resist been broken. It thus failed completely to be the decisive battle that Napoleon had been seeking. The Russians now decided that even Moscow could be sacrificed in order to continue the struggle. In making this decision, the Russian commander-in-chief announced, "Napoleon is like a torrent which we are still too weak to stem. Moscow is the sponge which will suck him in." Accordingly, the Russian armies withdrew to the east of Moscow to regroup and rebuild their strength, and they just abandoned the city to the French. In mid-September, Napoleon's army entered Moscow. Soon afterwards, a fire broke out that devastated much of the city. Whether it was set by the Russians, the French, or was just an accident is uncertain. But the effect was to render the city less habitable for the French. Certainly, there were some Russians who deliberately destroyed their own homes so as to deny them to the French. The governor of Moscow burned down his own house, leaving a note attached to the ruins that read, "I voluntarily set the house on fire that it might not be polluted by your presence. You will find only ashes." For all Napoleon's supposed successes, beating the Russian army in a major battle, capturing the main Russian city, the war still dragged on. All of his plans for a quick victory had come to nothing. Here was a foe that defied conventional expectations of how to defeat an opponent. Confronted with this dilemma, and perhaps also suffering from some health problems, Napoleon was seemingly struck with an uncharacteristic lethargy and indecisiveness. He lingered in the ruins of Moscow, vainly hoping that his occupation of the city would force the Russians to negotiate terms with him. But they refused to even talk. Meanwhile, the weeks were slipping by, and the window of opportunity for withdrawing his army back to Poland before winter came was closing. On October 13th, the first light snow fell on the city, and this event seems to have finally galvanized Napoleon into action. Swallowing the bitter pill that the invasion had failed to achieve its strategic objective, he realized that the priority now was to extract what was left of his army so that it could live to fight another day. He still had about 100,000 good men, and this included a large percentage of his very best, most experienced, and most valuable troopers. The departure from Moscow was actually a cheerful affair. The soldiers were happy to be heading home. Sources tell us that they boisterously sang songs as they marched out of the city. The men were heavily burdened, not only with their own military equipment, but with an often bizarre assortment of booty that they had picked up in Moscow. One grizzled veteran listed the items that he carried crammed into his knapsack, and these included several pounds of sugar, half a bottle of liqueur, a woman's Chinese silk dress, a woman's riding cloak, assorted gold and silver ornaments, 2 silver picture frames, the spittoon of a Russian prince, a porcelain Chinese vase, and supposedly a piece of the cross of Ivan.